In The Politics of Authenticity, Marshall Berman pointed out how the notion of authenticity in modern time is bound up with the radical rejection of things as they are, with a climate of personal and social renewal, ambiguity, contradiction, with the season, the modernity, in which all that is solid melts into air. To be modern means to be authentic then in terms of being able to change and resist within the unstable process of the historical flow. Said that, and taking into account the list of artists Achim Borchardt-Hume, curator at the Whitechapel Gallery in London, has devoted his attention to in the last few years, from Joseph Halberts to Laszlo Moholy-Nagy and Mark Rothko, to Doris Salcedo, Mona Hatoum and Walid Raad, we asked him how the intersections and friction between authenticity, freedom and politics have informed the artistic practice since the modernist avant-garde to the youngest generation of artists, and how their political and ethical dimension has changed in step with the utopian nature of art.
The way I tend to think about art is that it creates a space that otherwise doesn't exist. So that there are human experiences, whether they are individual or communal, that it is difficult to process or to think about in different ways. So how to break out of very fixed thought patterns that are being imposed upon you by circumstances. And that one of the things that art can do by creating an open aesthetic experience is to create this space where you can rethink the world in a different way. I think just the act of making art is political. I think it's always something to do with reimagining the world in a different way. It's always something to do with not being, I guess, satisfied, convinced, happy with the way you experience the world as it is at this particular moment in time. And you want to change something, you want to act something, and one way of imagining that action is by making art. I think at the beginning of the 20th century, of course, when you mentioned the Bauhaus and Alvar Moholy, I think there was this moment of incredible potential. I think there were a lot of people who felt that technological progress, greater democracy, might hold the key to solving a lot of the problems that had constrained people. I think the challenge to some degree was it didn't quite take account of human nature of the individuals, and of course they were all deeply conflicted within themselves. I mean, I always thought it was curious, even within one artist's position, that you have somebody like Albers who paints abstract all his life and then spends the last 20 or so years painting homage to the square, was this photographer of surreal objects that he encountered in the city. So there was almost like that was the flip side, something you couldn't quite suppress. I think it changed enormously because of, in the West, and I think ultimately we're talking about a modernist project here, even if people like Walid come from Lebanon or Mona originally comes from Lebanon or is Palestinian, but I think it's a modernist Western project where it starts. Obviously it's hugely changed by the history of two world wars and the Holocaust. And utopia suddenly seems quite difficult to obtain. So I think it has very much to do with now exposing the cracks and crevices, which with preventing people from forgetting. But I also think amongst the younger generation of artists, there's a curious dynamic now of not just being critical of that or exposing it as impossible, or being mournful that it hasn't been achieved, but actually to think, well, maybe there were ideas there that were actually, that are really worth holding on to, but maybe just have to do it by different means. Maybe it isn't through big political action, maybe it isn't through revolutions, maybe it's actually a slower process through individual gestures. And I think that's where the ethics come into politics, that this individual conduct, I think, takes on a bigger role. I think there are quite a number of artists who who in much more humble ways, I think, try to work it out and share this process of working out and also share this moment of doubt. So it's not this claiming, I know where we have to get to, which ultimately is a very inhuman thing. I mean, I think this was one of the big problems with the modernist utopia, was to think, I know exactly what endpoint should look like. But that is like death, because we can't do that. I mean, humans are about continuous development and constantly being in flux, I think, individually and on a wider level. We cannot be fixed entities at that point. I mean, the only fixed moment in our life is death. So I think that is the big flaw with that utopian idea. But a lot of the ideas that, you know, we have to rethink the way we live together, we have to rethink, you know, proper political issues of how capital is being distributed, about access to education, about equal rights for people, all of that. But how is that, how can you get there through individual action in a meaningful way? And I think there are a lot of artists grappling with those things now. And I should also say, I don't think it needs to be topical. I don't think work needs to be about that. I think actually by the ethical conduct, an artist takes part in that project. So it can be a painter doing something completely different. But if it is about the painting, about a reflection of what does it mean to act something out, I think it takes part in that project.
Coming to the youngest generation of artists, we could almost trace a common path in the way history, private and public memory come back together in their practice. We asked the curator whether this revaluation process of history is the symptom of a wider and social openness and interest towards our past and its controversies.
I think the way that you deal with your past is the way you will deal with your future. The two things are completely connected, or certainly the way you deal with your present moment. I do think you're absolutely right. It's very fascinating that even in the context of this prize here at the Strozzina, there seems to be a preoccupation amongst a younger generation of artists who's actually quite far removed from those historic events to almost practice an insistence on not allowing society to forget something. One thing which I think is very curious, when I, the last exhibition that I curated at the Whitechapel Gallery, which was the first big exhibition with Walid Raad and the Atlas Group about the civil wars, or inspired by the civil wars in Lebanon. And one of the things which Walid and I talked a lot about was the question of being part of an historical event, witnessing it, and the difference to experiencing it, and that perhaps there's almost like a generational lapse between it, that the people who are right in the midst of it don't actually have time to digest it and to work it through, and that that may come only with the next generation or the generation after that. I also think it's curious that there's an element, I think, of discontent with the workings of a late capitalist society, which wants to create this continuous present moment, as though everything is just about the instantaneous wish fulfillment now. I've got the wish, I can go out and buy it. I feel there's a kind of resistance in saying, actually, I want to think about something which happened 60 years ago, and I can't change it, but I know that somewhere it has still an effect on me. And I guess the third dimension, which I find quite fascinating about that, is that when we talk about globalization now, very often the way the term is used is really connected to the free flow of capital across the world. It's to do with trade and with currencies going across borders. But I wonder actually whether there isn't a different type of globalism or globalization which has to do with the interconnectedness of our histories, that actually very quickly, from my being German, I connect to other people across Europe. I very instantly connect to people, say at the moment, because I've done some work there in the Middle East, quite literally. I mean, we trace back our histories in within the space of going back 50 years, bang, they're together. The people are living right next there. And to me, this is quite an important dimension to understand where we are in this world now. One of the curious things about history is that, of course, it does happen, it is real. So when one talks about the fictitious nature of historic narrative of the documentary, I think one mustn't lose track of the fact that this is also real. This does really happen. This does really affect people's lives. But that perhaps one way of coming closer to understanding the nugget of truth at the center of it, maybe, strangely enough, this may be easier by working it through in a slightly fictitious way. That by always insisting on documentary facts and narrating statistics or events by date, or you don't actually come really close to what that means to human people. You can't narrate a war just by citing dates, battles, numbers of fatalities. To really understand what this means, there needs to be a human dimension, I think, because storytelling is so profoundly human. It's something which we do, all of us do. We tell ourselves a story every day, every minute of the day in our heads. To me, it felt like you come closer to a certain type of truth by feeling your way towards it through these stories.
As Jus Martinez says, the best aerobics for the brain is to see exhibitions. We ask Achim Borchardt-Hume whether he does agree with this statement and what kind of sense-making or experience he expects an exhibition to trigger.
It's curious because I've never really thought about it in those terms, but when you just mentioned this, the image it triggered in my mind was that of a neuron accelerator, that it's about making connections and to make more and more and more of them in unpredicted and in unpredictable ways. So ideally, I think an exhibition ought to make connections that not even I or the artist will be able to predict, and that they ought to accelerate. So you start with something quite simple, focused, something which feels like quite firm, but then by bringing different works together in one space, hopefully they all begin to make connections between each other, and they will zigzag, they will go across and connect more and more, and out of that comes a force field. So suddenly you can connect two things that may have seen oppositional beforehand, and something completely new come out of it. I can only think of exhibitions as related to space. I think ultimately what an exhibition is, an experience, and first and foremost I think it's a physical, visual, quite intuitive, almost instinctive experience, and thinking in a way comes with it at the same time, but often at a slight relay. And so I can only conceive of exhibitions in relation to a particular space, and it's like a choreography. It's a body moving through and an eye roaming. And I guess the first body moving through and the first eye roaming is my own. I sort of felt over the years that there is the way I feel it remains most truthful is if in a way I try to capture the journey that I've been on myself with an artist's work. So not to assume a position of I know much more about this, but more a position of I share this journey of discovery with others, and they may find other things which then again make me rethink something I knew. But it's always something to do with, I guess, movement in space, with pacing, with the speed or the slowness of things, and how they physically connect to one another.
Over the last year, the Whitechapel Gallery in London has displayed more than 60 works from the Dimitri Daskalopoulos private collection. We talk about risks and potentialities of the private-public relationship, about autonomy, network of connections, and we asked him the reason why a public gallery, such as the Whitechapel, turns to a private collection.
I'm intrigued about the public-private, and the question, your question, contains a huge number of assumptions about what is what and how that affects art. For one, the assumption is that public institutions are these critical stalwarts, that they should have a position of criticality, independence, objectivity, which I would all agree with the qualifier that we, of course, do not exist autonomously. We exist within a network of connections, and that is institutional and personal. We all know collectors, we all know dealers, we all know artists, we all know critics, we all talk to other people. And it's a community of like-minded people. So I think a lot of it comes down to the individual model, actually, of how it's being played out and what it means. The next question is very much about the works of art. Do the works get changed by being in a private collection or being in a public collection? So does the meaning of, let's say, to take a really curious example, somebody like David Hammons, who will not collaborate with any institution, with an institutional framework, but is very happy for his work with all its highly charged political content about ethnic identity and power structures, to go into private collections. And by working with Daskalopoulos, we could show works by David Hammons, which otherwise would be near impossible. So that's curious. What does that mean to do that? I think within the context of the Whitechapel, there's a very clear statement about working with these collections that otherwise are not publicly accessible. And I often think when the question is asked, well, what would the alternative be? You would say, we absolutely don't do it. So all these works just disappear from view. There will be works having been made, they will exist in reproduction, but nobody should get to see them other than the few people who are invited to somebody's house. That seems an odd alternative to me as well. So they are being brought back into a public arena. They're being made accessible to art history students, to curating students. I mean, is there a dynamic of enhancing the standing of Dimitris's collection? Yes, of course. It's public now. It has a record. It has been looked at by me for whatever that is worth, with, you know, a very clear agreement. I do not suggest anything in terms of the collection. I do not advise. I do not. But obviously, it has been looked at. I've made choices that you could say they indicate where to go or what to do with it. All of that is true. Will it enhance the value? Some works, yes. Other works, no. You know, Duchamp's fountain won't be worth more for having been shown at the Whitechapel Gallery. A young artist's work, maybe. Happens with every other exhibition, we're all entangled in these things. I try to understand why the assumption always is that it's all to the negative, which is not to put a pretty spin on it, but just to find a way forward, actually, to work through what is a very human and thus a very messy entanglement of different parties, but out of which also something great could come. I think it's really important to pay attention to specific situations. So museums in the States, very different from Britain. In Britain, museums and public galleries are essentially public services. They're either educational charities or they are civil service. I mean, literally, when I worked at Tate, I was a civil servant. In the States, museums are by and large private. The board is very different, the way it's set up. In Britain, the board is really a mechanism of accountability, not of influencing an institution. And you could go on, you could say, you know, it's different in Germany, it's different in Italy, it's different. But I think it's important to keep track of. It's again, it's a little bit similar. Do collectors come and say, I would like you to do that and I will give you a lot of money? I think that is highly problematic. At the same time, we have to be very honest about the fact that if we, whatever we do, we will go out to individuals and ask for their support. So you do begin to enter into relationships. Is this necessarily a negative? I don't know. It's also the assumption that the public one comes free of any strings. And although, of course, I think it's an extraordinary privilege that we still have public funding for the time being in Britain, and hopefully this will continue. Of course, this comes with certain ideas as well as to what art should do within the public sphere, how institutions should operate, what their prerogatives should be. And in a way, you could say maybe it's quite a good mechanism to have these things together, and there are different four spheres, and something quite productive will come out of it. What I do think is, it's a little bit like when talking before about modernism and utopia. It won't stand still. And I think a lot of the debate, how it's still being conducted about public-private, is an idea that is essentially one that goes back to the 60s or 70s about what a public institution is or what it is to be. This idea of independence, which is actually lagging behind what the reality is, where I see every very intellectually independent, critical, young curating student being very happy to make their first contact and be invited to somebody's house or to go to dinner at a big opening. So it's only a question of time until all these people are entangled in a network of personal relationships. And I think it's somehow time to rethink this, what that actually means and where the real dangers lie, but also where the real opportunities lie.
RadioPapesse.org